and welcome to another episode of Consumer, the European podcast of the Consumer Choice Center. As always, I'm your host, Bill Words. With Billy Joel's Pressure fading out in the background, this is the episode of September 23rd, 2021. As always, if you support this podcast, you can show your appreciation by making a donation at consumerchoicecenter.org/donate. And of course, also follow our colleagues at Consumer Choice Radio, my colleagues Jarl Sowski and David Clement, on different radio stations, both in the US and Canada, and also available as a podcast wherever you are listening to podcasts right now. This week, we'll be talking to Alice Watson-Brown. She is undertaking an undergraduate degree in political science and quantitative research methods at the University of Bristol, and she's a Young Voices advocate. We'll be talking about national insurance tax hikes in the UK, what they mean for patients and consumers, and why she thinks it's a bad idea. Also in this episode, two airline CEOs are criticizing the narrative on alternative fuels for aviation, and also the farm to fork strategy is facing backlash from the farming lobby, which says that the farm to fork strategy will cost more to consumers and will be bad for farmers, and therefore it needs more study. And lastly, I'm also talking to Fred Roeder, managing director of the Consumer Choice Center, about should Germany introduce speed limits for its motorways. So let's get started. Two airline CEOs are criticizing the narrative on alternative fuels for flights. So this is something that has been going on in the European Union for a while now. Airlines, of course, being criticized for having a chunk in the overall carbon dioxide emissions of the continent and being pressured to find alternatives to make flying greener. Of course, that is quite a challenge. And so alternative fuels, green fuels, have been on the agenda there. Basically here, changing the mix of the kerosene and the way it's produced in order to make it greener. But two airline CEOs, one is EasyJet's CEO Johan Lundgren, and also the CEO Barry Biffle of Frontier Airlines, which are criticizing it. Barry Biffle says, a lot of people had jumped on the bandwagon of greener fuels and compared the idea to clean coal. Johan Lundgren, EasyJet's boss, according to Politico, said greener fuels should be reserved for long-haul flights, while short-haul operations, like his, should instead focus on improved technology. Improved technology, indeed, very interesting. If you compare the older aircraft, the ones that we used in the 1960s, to today's aircraft, there's absolutely no comparison. Overall, we see that we have lower kerosene consumption, considerably lower kerosene consumption, also on the much newer models. If you look at Airbus, for instance, the A320neo, having 30% less kerosene consumption than the earlier models. So I think a lot is happening in aviation already, but it's interesting also to see how the aviation sector responds differently to which green fuels and which technological innovation is overall possible. I think on the routes in Europe where people have the alternative of using high-speed rail, it's just more convenient to do so. I remember, traveling from Brussels to London, you don't actually even want to take a flight because you end up in an airport that's too far away and you have the hassle of waiting while the Eurostar takes you all the way there. And same going from Luxembourg to Paris or Brussels to Paris, high-speed rail makes it convenient. Now, for those in the transport policy area that want to create high-speed rail connections everywhere in Europe, that is just very difficult. Let's say, you wanted to connect Warsaw and Bratislava with high-speed rail. The work necessary to even get that done far outweighs the benefits there. So I think for some countries, it does make sense to create high-speed rail connections to make it more convenient and also environmentally friendly. But we shouldn't give ourselves into the illusion that we can connect the entire continent, because unlike what you see on Google Maps, there is actual different topography, there's different altitude levels, there's mountains in between, and it's not really that easy to do that by rail. And I think what we need to challenge is the overall notion that as a result of this realization, we should travel less. People should travel, should be able to connect to grow their businesses, to connect with people, friends and family. Flying will very much be in our future. And it's technological innovation that can make it better, but we just cannot phase it out. I think that has just been very clear, unless you're really on the side of people who think that we should give up travel altogether. In other news then, Germany, as it's approaching an election, as usual, is always discussing whether it should introduce speed limits on its motorways. Germany, of course, being one of the only countries, if not the only country in Europe, that still has no general speed limit on its motorways. That doesn't mean that anywhere in Germany you can go without a speed limit on the motorway, but you know, many still don't have one. And so with the managing director and German, Fred Roeder, I talked about these speed limits. Do they make sense for safety purposes, for sustainability purposes, and for overall liberty? So take it away. So, Fred, as Germany is getting closer to the election at the end of the weekend, in this week, what is your view on this entire conversation about speed limits on German autobahns? Germany is famous for the fact that it doesn't have these speed limits on a large chunk, at least, of motorways in Germany. What's your view? Should there be restrictions for drivers?
This is a really old debate in Germany, and fortunately for motorists, Germany actually is de facto the only country in the world that has vast parts of its autobahn network without speed limits. Obviously, in areas where no speed limits could pose a lot of risk to drivers, there are speed limits, which often makes sense. But other than that, it is really the country of car freedom, which also really helps for branding, and it's just huge fun. Everyone has been on the German Autobahn with a decent car, had lots of fun doing this. The notion of introducing the speed limit comes usually from the Greens. I mean, the Greens are a party with a mindset of deceleration. Yeah, it's like this anti-growth sentiment. Oh, maybe we should actually grow less, or maybe the GDP should be smaller. And probably if you work in the public sector as all politicians and most supporters of the Green Party, you can have the luxury of promoting that. And of course, part of this is also don't take a 45-minute flight, rather spend 10 hours on a night train. It's this entire idea that there is no scarcity of time. And this is, of course, absurd. And we should rather look at how we can tackle the problems of the world. You know, we see now private astronauts, we see private space companies. Suddenly the third world has access to internet, fast internet, thanks to Elon Musk's satellites. And the German mindset is, what are we good at? Cars. Okay, let's ban internal combustion engines. Let's set up speed limits that then would even apply to electric vehicles. And let's decelerate and just waste more time on sitting in trains. Is this a good idea? Probably not.
So there was something interesting that I picked up recently. The Cologne Institute for Economic Research actually looked at the impact of speed limits on both the environment and safety. And what was interesting, what they found out, 77% of drivers in Germany already drive slower than 130 kilometers per hour. Only 12% drive between 130 and 140. And only 2% of drivers drive faster than 160. And what they also found out is that the impact that a speed limit would have on emissions is very, very little. So no impact, like a speed limit would have no direct impact on safety and no real impact on emissions. So very interesting there as well. Any ideas on those research?
Bill, everyone who has driven a car in his or her life and has gone to a gas station knows that you burn much more fuel if you drive fast. So there is already a price indicator on speeding, because you just use exponentially much more fuel, which is even in countries where it's not taxed as much as in Germany, you spend more to get from A to B if you speed. And the price function then usually lets people to drive slower who are more price sensitive. And those people who value either the thrill of safely driving fast or of getting a couple of minutes earlier, arriving a couple of minutes earlier, who value that more, spend more, and have to hit the gas station a couple of times more. So that already exists, and that's therefore it also totally makes sense that there's no big implication for the climate because not so many people speed. The German Autobahn is a beautiful example of spontaneous order and how people actually choose the lane they want to be in, depending how fast they want to be and how respectful people actually are to each other, thanks to the freedom they have, because it's not as much regulated as in other parts of the world. And if you look at fatal traffic as accidents, a country like the US, which has very strict speed limits and lots of traffic police, has much worse traffic fatalities and more crashes. So Germans' highways are actually a beautiful way of spontaneous order and subsidiarity and respect between among individuals. So probably any additional intervention coming there from usually politicians that don't even drive themselves because they have their own chauffeur, would mess up this beautiful social institution called Autobahn.
In other news then, the farm to fork strategy of the European Commission is facing backlash from the farming lobby. The farm to fork strategy is a strategy by the European Commission which sets out how to reform the overall food sector in Europe, making it more sustainable, using less crop protection, meaning pesticides, and also increasing organic agriculture. So I've talked about this on the podcast very many times. I just wanted to bring in what Kopa Kojeka, the most powerful, I would say, farming lobby in Brussels, has to say about this. They've pointed out that there have been new studies published by researchers at the University of Kiel in Germany and the Eurocare consultancy. They found that the farm-to-fork strategy would bring about a decline in agricultural production and exports and a rise in food prices for European consumers. That is very much in line of what the United States Department of Agriculture has previously found, which saw that overall food prices were going to be on the rise, and also Europe is going to be less likely to be exporting its food, which is already problematic given this current pandemic situations and also the effects of climate change on farming. I think we can just not afford to do that to consumers and farmers around the continent in order to give in to this ideal that is actually not necessarily environmentally friendly. And you know, if you want to find out more about this, I do recommend the publications page of consumerchoicecenter.org, where I've wrote a lot about agriculture and all of these different strategies and policies. A lot of the op-eds that we write also about this topic. I think farming is really at the core of the ideological battle in Europe about sustainability and different approaches to farming. So I do recommend you check that out. I find it interesting that Kopa Kojeka is now so openly against the farm-to-fork strategy, or at least saying that we should delay any decisions until we have more study, which is actually a reasonable position to take. So let's see what is yet to come there. But now let's move to the interview of this week. My guest is Alice Watson-Brown. She's undertaking her undergraduate degree in political science and quantitative research methods at the University of Bristol. And she's a Young Voices advocate. And we'll talk about national insurance tax hikes in the UK as announced by Prime Minister Boris Johnson. What does it mean for consumers and patients? So let's see if we can kind of get a hold on what exactly is happening in the UK, why it's happening, and what Alice thinks about it. So Alice, the UK is considering a tax hike. This is a social care tax, and that's, it's supposed for the specifically vulnerable populations, elderly populations that will be needing those that social care. That means tax increases for, I think, almost everyone. It just explained to us exactly how that works, which levers are being twisted and turned here, and what it means for the average taxpayer.
Yeah, so, well, first of all, thank you for having me on here. But so this is the National Insurance Tax Levy. National Insurance is a contribution which over 16s pay who work and earn an income, which aid your pension and qualify you for benefits ranging from maternity allowance to bereavement support. And it's usually around 12% of their income. So this proposal, it's means that people are going to pay £1.25 more to the pound And just to put that into context, so a 21-year-old earning £20,000 per year would pay an additional £104 per year towards national insurance. And this tax rise is after it's coming into effect in April 2022. And then from 2023, it will become a separate tax, which is known as the health and social care levy. So it'll be the same, but just with a different name, so hypothetical tax, as it were. And it's payable, it's not payable on rent income, but it is payable on dividends and pensioners' earnings. But this is projected to only affect 10% of pensioners over the age of 65, because not all of them are earning, obviously. So it's, the problem here is that there's going to create a huge generational divide on how much tax you pay, as well as increasing the wealth gap. So lowest earners are set to pay an extra £250 per year, which is, you know, really not great considering the housing crisis, recovery from the pandemic, especially. We do not need the highest taxation rate since the Second World War, and, you know, people are not rich at the minute. And so the problem is also is that with pensioners who are going to be paying this tax, we have this thing in the UK, it's called triple lock pension scheme, where it sort of the pension rate rises around 2% a year as what goes on with inflation or income rises. But these pensioners are going to be increasing their national insurance payments whilst not receiving their pension benefits. So it's not actually helping the people that the taxes aim to help for, which just proves that paying people to work, as the UK has been doing over the pandemic, and subsidize, state subsidizing of life and living, doesn't work. It doesn't benefit anyone. It doesn't benefit the old or the young. It just makes people more and more at the hands of the state and unable to get out of debt.
And so Boris Johnson seems to argue here that this is necessary because of the COVID pandemic. This is an addition. This is a reaction to the COVID pandemic. So what exactly is not working that these additional funds are needed? What have calculations on pensions and social care not been made correctly? What was the problem?
Well, first of all, you remarked that this is the effect of the pandemic. I think this is the direct effect of lockdowns rather than pandemic itself. I think this very easily could have been avoided if the government had examined its principles and the data in front of it and decided not to plunge the UK into two unnecessary lockdowns, as well as, you know, extending the furlough scheme forever, it seems. But it's supposedly going to, the first 3 years is going to go into the NHS. They're planning to raise £12 billion a year to tackle the waiting list and things like that. But it seems that it hasn't been quite like that. As soon as they've announced it, they've announced six new general management positions in the NHS, all on six-figure salaries, one of whom is in charge of telling white people that they should be scared to go into hospital, that they shouldn't be comfortable at the hands of the NHS, which, to be honest, I don't think is anything. It's a huge abandonment from the purpose of the NHS, which is to help sick people. It's unnecessary. We don't know. Obviously, a lot of Conservative MPs are calling for more transparency about where this money is going to go within the first 3 years, and how that's going to happen afterwards. How are you going to cope with pumping an extra £12 billion a year into the NHS for 3 years and then suddenly taking it out into social care? How is it going to cope? And I think rather than just pumping money into the NHS, we need a huge restructuring. Everyone says that. I think we need to cut general management in half. More than half the NHS staff in England aren't actually doctors or nurses. They are management. And I was speaking to someone who is on the sort of graduate apprentice management scheme. And she was saying in a hospital in London, there are cupboardfuls of equipment that are out of date, expired, that the management ordered, no one's used, and it costs around £100,000. And if that's just one hospital in London, then what on earth is going to be happening around the rest of the country? So it's obvious that the management are not, it's not fit for purpose. There needs to be restructuring. You can't just pump money into it. And when it comes to the social care, no one can deny that care, you know, social care is so expensive. It's not just for elderly people needing to be treated for dementia in nursing homes. These are children needing foster care. And that's what we really care about, as well as reducing the waiting list for the NHS, 5 million people, helping cancer patients. So in the last, this is pre-pandemic, in the last 6 years, 55,000 cancer patients should have been diagnosed more quickly. this is where the money should be going, not into six-figure salary management bureaucrats who just sit there and, you know, make life worse for everyone.
If I'm reading The Guardian or The Independent, they tell me that the Conservative Party is trying to create more flexibility by getting the private sector into the entire healthcare business, more private sector involvement. Eventually, they're trying to get rid of the NHS and all the other social care programs because the private sector will be taking that over, much like the United States. Is that something that's actually happening in the UK? I know this has been a conversation all throughout. The private sector becomes more important because the NHS just can't cope with the workload. Do you think that's actually a plan that the government is pursuing?
I don't think so. I don't think the government wants to privatise the NHS. I think there are obviously public-private partnerships which are essential for equipment and supply chains and things like that. That was seen a lot under Tony Blair. But no way do they want to privatise it. It is, well, before the pandemic, people were very proud and admiring the NHS for the work they did. I mean, my brother works in the NHS and I'm just like, you know, I'm very proud of him for what he's doing. But I think no one looks at the US system of care and goes, oh, we want our country to be like that. It has is far more expensive and far less effective than what we have in the UK. So I really think that The Guardian sort of is pursuing a political road here to try and scare people. It's sort of a political mechanism. There has been no indication from any minister that I have seen that's been on the news at all that they want to, you know, increase privatization of the NHS.
This whole thing is entirely, I mean, goes a bit beyond the initial scope of this conversation, but I think it's very fascinating because the NHS, whenever I have my British friends talking about it, it's very central. I mean, you even have most of continental Europeans don't even know the acronyms of our social security system, but, you know, in the UK, people quite religiously support it. And when I look, you know, currently I'm in the Netherlands, where there is actually no national health insurance system. The government requires you to be an insured, but you can choose from a lot of the private organizations that offer it. And there's actually a lot of flexibility and people really like it. And Netherlands is priding itself in one of the best healthcare systems and also a very resilient pension system where you can actually reduce your pension contributions as well by up to by 30% and also privately contribute to pensions. Why is the UK, okay, this is a loaded question, but why is the UK so married to its healthcare system and everything being done by the government and no flexibility being allowed for consumers and patients? Because it's not just the US that does it differently. I mean, if you look at Switzerland or the Netherlands, which are, you know, have much better outcomes, they also allow more private involvement and more choices for patients and consumers.
Well, I agree. I think choice is a very important thing, especially in a liberal democracy and a free market society. I mean, you do have the choice. A lot of employers give free health insurance to their workers. So we have Bupa. I don't know if you have Bupa in Europe. It's probably very ignorant. It's a health insurance that you get free healthcare checks. You can go see a psychiatrist for free and it'll be covered by insurance, which would probably take around 6 months in the NHS. So people are not, before the pandemic, this is before, the people were under no illusions that the NHS was flawed, but they didn't. We were like, wow, the NHS is great. I can be seen for free and be cured if in an emergency. But I think for operations and quite complicated health treatments, people were more likely to go private. Whereas since the pandemic, it has now become a religion. And it's quite a bit scary. And people have forgotten that the NHS is a public body and has to be held to an account, because the way the NHS functions is a direct reflection of how, you know, the Social Secretary for Health and Social Care is you know, doing his job and how the Chancellor is doing his job. So it's a direct reflection of the government, which people are forgetting. You can't be anti-government and sort of pro-NHS. It's quite weird. It's people have, you know, signs everywhere saying, thank you, NHS. And since the COVID, and all it is about is the NHS now. Britain is now no longer a state with a health service. We are a health service with a state. A lot of people would disagree with me and call me some kind of bigot and I don't care about the health of people, but that's just not true. I mean, I care about the health of everyone, but it's choice, it's about accessibility, and it's about the lack of pressure. And I think pumping this money into the NHS just isn't effective. You can't just shove money at something and expect it to cure itself overnight. And I think everyone knows that. No one's under the illusion of that. But I think over the last year, we've noticed so much more propaganda from the NHS, especially targeted at my age group. So I'm 21, getting vaccinated, going to see your GP not in person, getting tested twice a week, going back to university. It's all over the radio. And you think, why are you telling me to do this? I'm in charge of my health and I go to you when I need it. That's your job. So I think attitudes have really shifted over the past year. People are now, you know, people who beforehand were sort of, oh, I like the NHS, now love the NHS. And now people are sort of very anti it because they see it, that it represents some kind of authoritarian propaganda.
What is interesting, yeah, when I talk to British friends of mine, is that very often the people who are most supportive of the NHS are not the ones really using it. They do find alternatives to not having to use it because of, you know, those waiting times that you do have in the UK, which is fascinating because, you know, one of the most developed countries on the European continent, but then also people do wait for their treatments. So just to get back on the national insurance payments that people will have to make, what I saw is that they're really the opposite of progressive taxation, because as income taxes progressively increases as you make more money, the national health contributions, they don't really. So it seems to be a bit of a regressive tax where the people on lower income seem to be paying more for this increase that is planned by the government than those on higher incomes. So it seems that the larger part of the payments will be shouldered by those people who already make less, which seems counterintuitive to me, if because especially those people are the ones most affected by COVID-19 and would need to be able to get out of this problem.
You're completely right. I think it's a shambles, really. Yeah, it's going to be affecting the young and the poorer people of this country who rely on the NHS more. So it's, people are just not, they don't, I don't think they quite understand that the after effects of this. And the tax, it doesn't encompass, say, capital gains tax, for example, where, you know, where you buy an asset and you get taxed on the gain you made, which is what rich people have. And I think if it were me and we had to pump more money to the NHS and you held a gun to my head and I was in the cabinet office, I would just say tax more, tax less, but across more versions of income. So rent income, that you don't have to pay national insurance on that. And a lot of people make a lot of money out of renting. And as well as dividends and capital gains, there are those kind of modes of income which aren't taxed yet. But if you tax those more forms of income, and people won't feel the hit as more, and so they'll be less likely to try and avoid it and less likely to, you know, be angry, and they might even win more votes in the next election by doing that, who knows.
And that concludes this week's episode of Consumer. Thank you so much for listening. You can follow Alice Watson Brown at Alice Watson Brown on Twitter, and of course follow the Consumer Choice Center as well at Consumer Choice C. As always, I'm your host, Bill Words. See you Thursday.
You have to learn to pay. Just like everybody.